Before we begin, Judge Jordan, I'd like to say that we are delighted that the Honorable Robert Hinkle, the United States District Judge from Northern District of Florida, is with us on the bench, and we're going to have a good time. We'll begin with Griffin versus Aetna.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is W.A. Griffin, both appellant, and self-represented party. May I appease the court? The district court simply got it wrong when they held that the applicable statute of limitations for statutory penalties under ERISA 29 U.S.C. 1132C is 1 year. The reason the district court got it wrong is twofold. Number one, the district court relied exclusively on this court's holding in Harrison versus Digital Health Plan. Harrison can be found in Westlaw 1157098. The second reason the district court got it wrong is because it failed to acknowledge the most recent Georgia Supreme Court holding in the state of Georgia versus Western Sky Financial. That case number is S16X1012, and that was in 2016. Because ERISA does not provide a statute of limitations for 29 U.S.C. 1132C, in Harrison, this court affirmed, with Georgia as the forum state, that the statute of limitations for failure to provide a COBRA notice was most comparable to Georgia statute OCGA 9328. That statute reads, all actions by informers to recover any fine, forfeiture, or penalty shall be commenced within 1 year.
Dr. Griffin, you think that the 20-year statute of limitation should apply?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I'll get into that later. However, the district court failed to analyze the nature of the statutory violations for failure to provide a COBRA notice versus the nature of the violations here. In Harrison, failure to provide or mail a COBRA notice is considered a common law statute, whereas statute 1132C is predicated on the statutory obligation triggered by plaintiff's statutory rights to request plan documents. If the court were to consider the nature of these violations, there is zero 11th Circuit case law that expressly states which state law should be barred to determine the statute of limitations for statutory penalties for failure to provide ERISA plan documents upon request. Because of this alone, this appellant feels as if the court should disregard Harrison in full at this point. These statutory rights and obligations afforded by 1132C are considered consistent with the rights which arise under legislative enactment and which would not exist except for some act of legislature, which is why OCGA 9322, it gives you 20-year statute of limitations, is relevant and more appropriate statute of limitations. That statute states all of the enforcement of rights accruing to individuals under statutes shall be brought within 20 years after the right of the action has accrued. Now, the most relevant case law that talks about this and incorporates all of the elements in this case can be visualized in beautiful case law and the most recent holding in the state of Georgia versus Western Sky Financial. It's just a gorgeous case because it goes into detail about The court discusses in details in former actions, and it talks about how informer actions originate as a subset of key TAM actions that subsequently evolve into two forms of statutory key TAM actions. One for informers who were not aggrieved, and one for actual aggrieved parties who could sue for those statutory remedies. And being that I'm not a lawyer, I can kind of understand just trying to fumble through that case. Just from my understanding, there were a lot of changes with penalty claims, key TAM actions, because back in the day there was a lot of litigation and there were vexatious litigants that took advantage of those statutes. And so over the course of years, what happened was they started tightening up, turning the key a little bit, and the court's goal was to make it so those claims are not taken advantage of by vexatious litigants. And so that's one of the reasons
Dr.
why...
Dr. Griffin, I've got a different question I need to get you to before you run out of time. If I understand it, you got an assignment from the patients at the time of the service, but that didn't cover this kind of a claim, didn't give you the right to ask for documents. Later, you got an assignment that you say relates back, that expressly says you have the right to ask for documents. Before you got that second assignment, that retroactive assignment, had the patient ever made a demand for documents from Aetna or Coventry?
No, Your Honor.
And since the time that you got that assignment, have you made a demand for the documents that's the subject of this case?
Since the second assignment? No, right. Your Honor, no.
So what did Coventry or Aetna do wrong? They said no to you at a point where you didn't have the right to ask for the documents. They've never said no to a proper demand for the documents. What are we doing here?
I'm kind of confused on your question. There are about four patients that I received assignment of benefits on. And one of those patients, I did receive a plan document of some sort. Patient TB from defendants. And additionally, the original assignment does state that this is assignment for benefits and for rights. However, it did not expressly state that those particular assignments were for statutory penalties. It did say benefits. But if you look at the docket and you look at the exhibits, you will see that throughout the course of appeals, the appeal letters let it be known that that assignment, the original assignment, was actually included or was intended to include, statutory penalties and breaches of fiduciary duty as well.
But that's not this case. We're here in this case only on the assertion that the retroactive assignment created the right that we're dealing with. Isn't that right?
Well, I guess yes and no. yes and no. Basically, based on the contract law that I understand, the patient and I both agreed that the original assignment would be retroactive before the second lawsuit was filed. So when this particular legal action was filed, I obtained another assignment. And it was retroactively effective back to the original assignment. So in essence, I wanted to cure the defect that the defendants brought to the table. Does that make sense?
I have it. The question was, what did Coventry or Aetna do wrong? And if they said no to a person who at the time had no right to ask for the documents, it seems to me they did nothing wrong.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at the whole case, I mean, it's a nothing but ERISA violations, failure to answer appeals, failure to turn over plan documents that determine how those claims were paid. There's something called rate tables and methodology. There are plan documents that were never received. So in essence, and then on three of them, I got nothing. Three other members, I didn't even get summary plan descriptions. So the bottom line is the defendants collected premiums, but they didn't honor ERISA law. They did not turn over summary plan descriptions. They did not turn over rate tables and methodology, and they didn't even turn over contracts that were requested repeatedly via certified mail.
Dr. I think we got your point. You saved some rebuttal time.
Okay.
You've saved rebuttal time.
Yes, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Tallman.
May it please the court, Gary Tallman on behalf of Aetna Health and Coventry Healthcare. This case is the second case filed by Dr. Griffin relating to these patients and treatment that occurred in 2012 and 13. The first was dismissed by at least the penalty claim was dismissed by Judge Totenberg because the assignment did not cover a right to proceed. Then Dr. Griffin got a retroactive assignment and refiled. We moved to dismiss on three grounds, first being that we're not the plan administrator, the employer is. Secondly, on this retroactive ground, and third, on the statute of limitations. Judge Totenberg ruled on the statute of limitations, but those other grounds are legal grounds that could be reached by this court.
Can I ask you a procedural question before you dive into the merits of your argument? Dr. Griffin, whether it was timely or proper or not, she made a request for documents in either late 2012 or early 2013, right, on behalf of one of the patients? Is that right?
I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. Do you know whether there were any other requests for any of the other patients?
I think she made requests for these five as outlined in the brief. I don't believe there were any subsequent requests either by the beneficiary or by Dr. Griffin.
I thought she had made the request in 2012 or 2013 for some but not all, but you think it might have been all of them, but then none after that?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
And so the issue that was raised by Dr. Griffin is the statute, and if I might address that, the 29 U.S.C. 1132C provides for up to $100 a day penalty for failure to provide certain information to ERISA plan beneficiaries in a timely manner, including COBRA notices and other plan documents. They're all covered by the same penalty provision, and it's like a contempt provision. It is intended to coerce timely dissemination of information, and that purpose is critical in determining what's the appropriate statute of limitations. But and of course, the inquiry is first, what is the state statute that is most closely analogous? This court has already ruled on that issue under 1132C1. In the Harrison case, and that holding was reaffirmed in the Cumming case in the COBRA context, but still it's the same provision, and the Fourth Circuit has directly addressed the question, should there be any difference in the two, and in the Presley case cited at page 16 of our brief said no, it's the same.
Part of the problem is that if you look at the text of the statute, and of course we have to borrow in a rough way because there's not much of a chance that a state statute of limitations provision is going to be based on the filing of ERISA claims. But here, the Georgia statute that you rely on and the district court relied on talks about claims by informers.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which the Georgia Supreme Court has now said are people who are like or a subset of qui tam relators. Dr. Griffin is not that, is she?
Well, Your Honor, I think that in the Western Sky case, the court did not address the much more closely analogous case of the Nunnally case cited in our brief that was also reaffirmed in the Busby case, where in the specific context of a claim that there was a failure to provide information in a timely way, in that case it was Western Union providing telegraph, that there was reason to read Informer broadly in that context. And understand that Western Sky was a much different kind of statute, and I believe the holding is really applicable to that kind of statute, which was intended to prohibit completely the activity. And so there the court, in analyzing both the application of 9.3.28 as well as the usury statute of limitations, looked at and said that the purpose was important in its inquiry, just as the purpose is important to this court's inquiry, because there isn't a statute of limitations in the payday lending statute. I think that the penal purpose and the coercive purpose of this statute is analogous to that Western Union one, and the court in the Nunnally case said it would be absurd to apply a 20-year statute. It dealt with exactly this issue. Is it 20 years or one? It said it would be absurd to apply a 20-year in the context where the purpose of the statute is to get that timely compliance. And also isn't that it would have perverse effects if you did that.
Wouldn't it also be absurd to allow a 20-year statute of limitations for a usury claim?
It would, and the court did not hold that. The court, usury claims are still covered by a one-year statute. Payday is different. Payday is more than usury. It is abusiveness that the General Assembly intended to eradicate. And so I believe, and it has both a compensatory and a penal aspect, to be sure. But I think the purpose there is to eradicate a kind of behavior, whereas here the purpose is to encourage timely dissemination of information. And so I would say the Western Sky opinion ought to be read in the context of what it is doing, and it did not overrule either Nunnally or the more recent Busby case, and it was certainly was aware of that construction. And these are limited cases where you have a purpose to encourage timely action by the actor, whether it be information or in the Busby case, it was timely payment of funds received by a county through fines and forfeitures. But it was to encourage that timely behavior. And I think as the Nunnally case clearly and correctly outlined, that to do otherwise would create perverse incentives, people sitting on their rights, as well as would lead for the possibility of harassing action.
But you can make that argument about anything that's covered by the 20. I mean, a 20-year statute of limitations is a long statute of limitations. You can make that argument about almost anything that comes within that provision.
But it's particularly apt, Your Honor, where there is a daily penalty. The incentive, if you were to apply a 20-year statute, would be to sit on your rights for 19 years, particularly if it is a plaintiff who is a vexatious filer. And no circuit has, when faced with this, has held that a long, a more than 3-year statute applies. I think this has been addressed, in the second, the third, the fourth, the eighth, have all held that statutes that are geared toward penalties and fines and forfeitures, somewhere between 1 and 3 years, were the applicable statutes.
But that's because those analogous state statutes weren't limited to claims by informers. They applied to all claims for penalties and statutory rights and forfeitures and the like. Those are pretty easy cases, it seems to me.
This one, I think, is the same because of the Nunnally and Busby cases have said in this context, informer should be read more broadly because of the specific purpose. And you know, Western Sky says what it says, but it says it in a much different context. And I would ask the court to consider that, because the inquiry here is not which statute literally applies, but what is the most closely analogous. And I think in that regard, you can't ignore the Nunnally and Busby cases, nor the purpose, nor the effect. And so to apply a 20-year rule in this context, I think would be not only a break with the other circuits, but it would be, I think, frankly, there's a binding ruling in the Harrison and in the coming case that would require an in-bank consideration. But I don't think there's justification for that here. I think that the policy reasons are firmly in favor of granting an affirmance here on the basis of it 9328 being the most closely analogous, and I do think that in the alternative, this court can address this case sufficiently by dealing with the undisputed evidence that we are not the plan administrator, that the employer is the plan sponsor, and the law is clear that in that context, the plan sponsor is the administrator, and there is I'll acknowledge there is the concept of de facto administrator that has been ruled to apply where the information duties are with the other party.
How can we tell that though from the plan documents?
We've cited it in our brief.
I mean, if someone's de facto, it's because it's not written, it's not mandated by the text of the plan. That's the way it is.
I think not, Your Honor. I think that de facto in that context means there is none designated, and so then you have to look to see who has the power of the or the responsibilities consistent with the plan administrator. That's my understanding of it. But here the plans do give the responsibility to disseminate information to the. To the plan sponsor, the employer. We've cited the provisions in our brief. And then further, I think the retroactive assignment, as Judge Hinkle indicated to us, I don't think you can assign, but I think further, the way this was done, there was not a valid request. And I don't believe we did anything wrong.
Do we apply federal law or state law on the assignment issue?
I believe this is a federal, it would be federal law would govern the rights under ERISA, but I believe
that's my understanding
of it, yes. I mean, I think, again, to the extent there's not federal common law, you would look to the state law for guidance, but I think ultimately that's a matter of federal law. And quite frankly, as is the decision of what's most closely analogous. That is a federal decision, and what the statute is a federal a matter of federal law, where there would be incorporation of obviously the state statutes. But I think ultimately this is a federal. Question for the court.
But I have it right that there was never a request by a person with authority to make the request that was denied.
Yes, I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
I think we have your case.
Thank you.
Dr. Griffin.
Again, Your Honors, the Georgia Supreme Court expressly held that OCGA 9328 applied to actions of informers and that it did not apply to actions by aggrieved parties. Here, the fact pattern in this case clearly documents that the plaintiff is an aggrieved party and can be concluded that the 20-year statute of limitations applies. Unlike other states, Georgia stands out in that it has a unique stance to protect the integrity of its citizens' statutory rights. The defendants talked about all the other case law where the statute of limitations is limited from anywhere from 1 to 3 years. However, the defendants failed to tell you that there are no other states like Georgia that actually have that particular statute. And that's the beauty of living in a state like Georgia. Georgia's tough on crime. So please, Your Honor, think about the impact that this would have on members, beneficiaries that have been mistreated by plan administrators such as Coventry and Aetna. This would be a statement, because I can assure you, if the court were to rule that the 20-year statute of limitations would apply, any citizen, member, beneficiary in the state of Georgia would probably have all planned documents within 24 hours that were requested if the court rules in my favor. Thank you.
Thank you.